Hello and welcome to Behind the Journey, and today I'm with Daniel Priestley. Daniel is one of the people I've followed for a very, very long time. You could say he was one of the people that created the whole personal branding movement. I'm talking to him today about all things business and where he believes the world is going. First of all, Daniel, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Look at your studio. It's great.
It's cool, isn't it?
So good.
Do you know what the mad thing is? And I think everyone watching this needs to understand. This is just so Dubai.
This is how it is.
This is how it is.
Everything you need, it's right here.
I've kind of realized and lived my life for the last 6 weeks since moving here that anything you want is pretty much an app away.
People have such misconceptions about Dubai. My goodness, they really think it's 30 years ago or something like that. This place is on fire at the moment. It's incredible.
Every single time I post anything, my friends ask me questions, they say sarcastic comments that are so unbelievable. I always say anybody who's got a negative opinion of Dubai probably has never even walked into this place.
No, and couldn't be further from the truth. Mm.
Yeah. I think for me, it was a case of obviously you're here right now. You're obviously visiting, doing whatever you're doing in Dubai. I send you a message, you're on the podcast. And that's the best thing about Dubai is that everybody is coming here for business to get things done. And it's a great group of like-minded individuals that are all here.
Yeah, the answer is yes. What's the question?
So the question I actually have to start this all off is, why are you in Dubai? What are you doing here?
Speaker at a couple of conferences. I got booked for one conference to come and speak, and then I told a few other people that I'd be out here, and then I got booked for two more conferences to speak here. I love coming here anyway. I've got global businesses, and Dubai's obviously frontier city. It's the future. I'm here doing business, speaking at conferences, et cetera, et cetera.
So one of the things you're kind of most known for is being an author, and I think the crazy thing when you look at your actual journey, your kind of business prospects, the thing you've all done, everybody goes, oh, Daniel Priestley, the author. I think it's kind of crazy that actually is the headline, the baseline. So can you kind of give the audience like a bit of background about who you actually are? Because you're not really an author, you know?
The non-author story,
that's
yeah.
The one.
So I'm an entrepreneur. I discovered entrepreneurship as a teenager and loved it and read all the business books. I got to be apprenticed when I was 19 to 21 in an entrepreneurial fast growth startup. So I had this experience of working very closely with a founder and learning a lot about entrepreneurial fast growth. Started my first company at 21. It exploded in revenue. We went 0 to 1 million, then 1 to 10 million in the following couple of years. So I was 24 years old with a national business in Australia. Over the last 20 years, I've built and sold several companies. I've built and sold mostly services companies and agencies. I've got a tech company. I currently have eight companies with offices in the UK, Australia, and Canada. And we do business all over the world. And along the way, written some books, had some babies, got a cat, beautiful wife, live in London, etc.
Let's go back to that kind of first book you wrote, you know, Key Person of Influence,
yep.
Which is probably the main reason that most people first discovered you. That was kind of how I first discovered kind of your whole thesis and what you're about. And kind of when you read that book, it really kind of opened your eyes to the way of kind of personal branding and how you should kind of put yourself further forward. What kind of opened your eyes to that actual mindset? What kind of created that vision for the book?
So I had been running events fairly extensively all through like early 2000s to 2010, and we had been hiring celebrity speakers to come in and speak, people on Dragon's Den and Shark Tank and best-selling authors and all of this sort of stuff. And what I noticed, you know, from our point of view was that if we got a good name speaker to come along, we could put 500 to 2,000 people in a room depending on the name of the speaker, and everything would flow from there. Like it was like the eye of the storm. This person would just kind of turn up and suddenly it was game on. And what I discovered is that from spending a lot of time with these people is that they don't have to chase anything. Everything comes to them. They are attracting opportunities. If they want to go on media, they can get media. If they want to launch something, they can launch it. If they want to raise money, they can raise money. And they don't even have to look very far. It all just kind of is circling them. And I kind of noticed this phenomenon of the key person of influence. And then the next thing that happened was social media really kicked off. There was this magical moment in 2008 where Barack Obama ran the world's first presidential election with social media at the very heart of it. That had never been done before. Up until 2008, social media was considered to be a toy. It was just a weird thing that kids were doing. And no one took it seriously. And then Obama comes along and he does this great campaign and wins the presidential election. And that was the moment where grown-ups went, oh, wow, we need to know about this whole social media thing. What's this Twitter thing? And what are these YouTube videos and all that? So for me, I put two and two together and I said, these are multi-billion dollar companies that are building engines for taking a personality, a personal brand, and multiplying them out to everyone. And I thought, this is going to be massive. Every single person is going to have to behave like my speakers on the stage. They're going to have to write a book. They're going to have a clear pitch. They're going to have to productize what they know. And I started basically saying, all right, what have I learned from famous speakers? And how do you then take that behavior, that best practice, and apply it to this social media landscape? So I wrote the book around 2009, 2010, right when that was just a brand new thing, at the very beginning of the whole social media personal brand revolution.
I think it's amazing when you read that book, you understand what it's about, you start implementing it, and then you go into one of the next books that I think is one of my other favorite books, which is Oversubscribed. Because Oversubscribed is almost that thesis that, cool, you're now the person.
Yeah.
Right, so do you want to go into kind of how you thought about that book and went from there?
So Oversubscribed is based on the idea that you have to create demand and supply tension. So there has to be not enough of something and too many people who want it in order for it to make profit. So the thesis is that you don't really make profit unless you're oversubscribed. And I'll give you a couple of examples. If you think about what business should make a profit because it has earned a profit, you would think about airlines. Airlines should make a profit. They have to do everything right, 100% safety. They've got to do amazing customer service, technology, innovation. All this stuff has to happen perfectly with an airline and they make 5% margins. You take a business that should never make profit but does, Rolex. So Rolex watches, they haven't innovated for 50 years. What watch today looks the same as a watch 50 years ago. You can copy their product for 1/10 of the cost and yet they're wildly profitable. Now, what's the difference? The difference is that Rolex is oversubscribed. It's a 18-month waiting list to get a Rolex, whereas an airline is always readily available. So I noticed in my businesses, when we first built up a waiting list, or if we first built a market who wanted something, and then we launched it and released it, we would be able to maintain a profitable business. And whenever we broke that rule and we actually just made things available whenever people wanted them, we magically didn't make any profit. So I got really religious about the idea that we don't do stuff unless we're oversubscribed. So if we've got a course that we want to sell, we're going to have 100 spots on the course, we're going to get 1,000 people to apply. If we're going to do a launch of some new software, some new technology, you're going to request access to the beta group. You're going to join a waiting list. Then we're going to release a beta group position. Then we're going to release the secondary group. And we're going to maintain a balance of being oversubscribed. And through going through this process many, many times, I documented steps and principles. And I started teaching the team, this is how we do it so that we're always oversubscribed and that we're profitable. And that method has served me really, really well.
I think, you know, whenever you look at books and authors, so many people will write books because they need to get another book out or they have a book deal. Some of the authors that I kind of follow and I read their books, sometimes it's very, very obvious that they have been forced into a four-tier book deal and they've got to three and they've run out of ideas and they've now made a four, which is the montage of them all together. You know, I read up about kind of your publishing company and stuff like that. And I think you created the publishing company with the idea that it kind of gives entrepreneurs the chance to write their own books and give them away. Is that the concept behind it?
Yeah, so I got published by a big publisher, a New York publisher called Wiley, and I got frustrated because we were at cross purposes with each other. They wanted me to sell books, and my time's too valuable to be running around selling a £10 book where I make £1.50 as a royalty. Like, why am I going to spend time doing that? And all I want to do is give books away. I just want to build relationships, and I'll tell you quickly why I want to do that. In the early parts of my career, I found that there was a lot of value in just meeting up with everybody and having a cup of coffee with as many people as I could. And I would fill every available slot that I had with a coffee meeting. So I would always get a private members club membership in London and I would stay in one place. And if I had an open slot the following day, I'd try and fill it with a few coffee meetings. And I knew that something magic always happened if I just met up with enough people for coffees. So I was trying to meet with, 100, 200 people a year in addition to my normal business, just having coffee meetings with people. And it was great. It was worth doing. But then I realized that I would always say the same sort of stories and I'd share the same sort of ideas and all that sort of stuff. And I thought, if I put it in a book, it's about the same cost to buy someone a coffee as to give them a book. And if I just give out books, rather than being able to do this with 200 people a year, I could do this with 2,000 people a year. So I thought, I just want to give away books. So the whole initial idea was, I just want to give away books to build relationships at scale. So I kept saying to my publisher, I just want to give them away. Like, I don't want to try and sell them. I want to buy thousands and give away thousands. Anyway, they resisted this idea and they wanted to sell them to me at retail price. And so I ended up buying a publishing company, and we have 900 authors now. All 900 authors, we teach them to give away 1,000 copies per year, and they do it as a way of building their businesses. Now I only publish through Rethink Press.
I think, the whole idea of allowing content to kind of do the networking for you is something I really believe in. One of my first businesses was an educational business, and we gave sample videos on YouTube for free. We'd get 25,000 views a day, wow, which then went into a shop where they could buy more products, etc. So this idea of record once or write once and give away a lot, I think, has been the backbone of many personal brands and businesses today. I mean, if you think, I love the idea of, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, we had a guy in our office called Sam, whose sole job was just to record things, record meetings. And then we'd break down the meetings and then just distribute them on the internet, because the amount of times a meeting would have more value to more than the one person in the room would be such a significant piece of information.
It
was also so weird. I'd go into meetings and have to say to people, like, would you mind, there's a cameraman in the room, I'm just going to record me. I just think there's some value that might be out for this room, which is going to help my marketing. So we literally would put out a video every single day on LinkedIn of me advising somebody on their marketing strategy. And obviously somebody else on the internet may have some value from that and kind of pass it on. So this idea of record once, share many times has been something that I've been a big believer in. The one thing that I've noticed kind of in the last, I would probably say 2 or 3 years, has been the space has become very, very crowded. Mm-hmm. This podcast, we probably launched 5 years ago now. There wasn't too many back then. There was still quite a few. But nowadays, there's often that comment on TikTok, which is, not everyone needs a podcast, right? Because it is very much a very, very busy space. Where do you see this place going? We've had the books, everyone's giving away books. We've had the internet, everyone's giving away information. We've had podcasts now, everyone's giving away information. Where do you see the market going next?
I probably see that it's going to consolidate around a smaller number of bigger brands. So very unfortunately and sadly, I do think that, and there will be exceptions to this rule, but the early adopter boom has already happened, and AI is going to do something pretty phenomenal in the next couple of years. Essentially, AI has two superpowers. So it has the superpower to make you consume more than you wanted to, and a superpower for a small number of people to get you to create more than you could. So we've all experienced superpower number one. If you're on TikTok and you doom scroll through 2 hours, 3 hours, and you sit there and go, how did that happen? I'll tell you how it happens. Each of these platforms builds a model as to who you are and how you respond. And while you're watching one video, 1,000 other videos are being tested against the model. And the best video is then presented to you, the real person. And then while you're watching that one, 1,000 other videos are being tested against the model and then presented to you. So that algorithm is doing a really good job of trying to find ways to get you to hyper-consume. It wants you to spend, your intention was to spend 20 minutes, we want you to spend 40 minutes. So AI has this ability to get some people to hyper-consume. On the flip side, we now have AI that helps you to hyper-create, and it creates three things. It creates intellectual property, media, and technology. So it can code, it can create ideas, and it can actually support with the creation of media. Now, the people who are already on this bandwagon, who are already doing this, are going to be the first ones to have that superpower. And they're going to create so much content that it'll be near impossible to keep up. It's kind of like if you are already a motor car driver and then the Formula One comes along and then you jump in a Formula One car, there's no way that anyone can now keep up with you. You're just too far ahead, too fast ahead. So this is an awkward situation. It's a little bit like real estate. My parents were able to easily get on the property ladder. They could buy houses at 1.5 times the household income. And now today, houses cost 10 times the household income. So it's nearly impossible to get onto the property ladder. I think that our kids will look back and say, wow, you were at the early stages, you were on the social media ladder, you were on the personal brand ladder, and it's impossible to get on that ladder anymore. Now, this is not like some new thing. When I was growing up, only a very small number of people got to be famous. Mm. There weren't, you know, social media was not for everybody. But I think the pendulum is going to swing back towards a small number of people who have massive followings, and or a relatively smaller number than we have today.
I think if you look back kind of 5-6 years ago, it was very much a quantity game where almost the quality didn't matter too much, because it was almost like, I'll put loads of content out, some of it will pop me off, it will resonate, and I'll be able to grow. And now, because there's so much content out there, I think we're kind of looping back now to the quality matters on such a high degree. The problem, I suppose what you're saying there, is the people who, the big boys now, can put out both the quality and the quantity. Yeah. So to try and become somebody, you're hoping an algorithm supports you in some way. You're waiting for the next TikTok to pop off. Yep. You're waiting for some next break, which is going to be a real big problem.
Yeah, and it is a problem. And recently I saw Gary Vaynerchuk release a video where this girl comes up and she says, hey, I've done all the things that you've talked about and it hasn't worked. And he says, oh, well, how many videos have you done? And she's like, 500. And he's like, how many blogs have you done? She's like, 500. And he has a look and he scrolls through and she's got like 400 subscribers across everything. And he's like, okay, something's not working. And that was the first time I saw it in his face, this look of terror of like, oh, wait a second, because I was telling people just get stuff out there and it'll all be fine. And suddenly he's like, okay, there are people who are getting stuff out there and it's not all fine. So the pendulum always swings. That's one thing I've learned in my years in business. The pendulum, whenever you think something's becoming a little bit weird this way, it swings back the other way real hard and real fast.
It levels everyone out.
Yeah.
I think as well, for me, is that a lot of the strategies that people like Gary Vee talk about, who is also, obviously, don't forget, incredibly successful in what he does, is there is not one rule for all. You know, so, like, I'm not a very good writer. I'm not very good at most things, right? But everyone has their own specific thing they're good at. So, you know, maybe you just can't be an influencer. Maybe it's just not your vibe. Maybe you just can't be that person that's going to be able to lead a million people into battle. And that's perfectly fine.
Yes.
You know, so you know, I wrote and talk a lot about the idea of being niche in your space. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be the marketing person for the world. You can be the marketing person for your small town.
Yeah.
You can be the financial advisor for your city. You don't have to be the person for everything, because reach is hard now, life is challenging. So zip it all in and focus on one area. And I kind of think that's the only real way now to break through.
High value, low volume is a really good strategy at the moment. So doing something of very high value for a low volume of people, which is the essence of niching or micro-niching, is really smart. You mentioned two niches there that I don't necessarily agree with, which is like geographically based niches. I'm a big believer that do almost any niche other than geography, because we live in this globalized world. I would almost rather that you're a financial planner for airline pilots on Emirates. Something that is like, it doesn't, like, I just don't want to be limited by that patch of land. I want to be limited by an idea, but not a patch of land, because some of the best value businesses now have 18 clients everywhere around the world, but they're super highly selected clients. But they all have this particular really big problem, and it's a problem around their circumstances. Very rarely is it a geographical circumstance.
I think as well, like, having those smaller businesses is sometimes much better. You know, I think you spoke about this actually, where I can't remember the exact phrase you use, and you'll be able to explain it better. But sometimes having a 100-person business, you know, and having the chaos and the life drag and the upset is just not worth having when you can have a 20-person business. And
well, lifestyle boutique versus performance business. Let me give you the exact numbers. So there is a size of business. Now we're talking team size, not customers. So team size of 3 to 12 people is a boutique, and let's say you've got a key person of influence who's got a bit of a brand, they've got a bit of a following, you can bring that person in if they've already got some traction. You've got a general manager, sales, marketing, operations, IT, maybe financial control, something like that. So you end up with 3 to 12 people covering some core roles, and you deliberately limit it so that you don't go past about 12 people. The perfect size is about 8. So the reason for that is once you go past 12 people, the business no longer self-organizes. You're too big to be small, too small to be big. You need managers, you can't afford managers. You need leadership team, you can't afford leadership team. You need a coach, you can't afford a coach. So all of these types of things start to creep in once you go past 12. It's terrible from 12 to about 40. So from 12 to 40 people, you're too big to be small, too small to be big, and you're constantly battling with both issues of being too small and too big, and it's a real drama. Once you get to 40, you end up with a 4 or 5 person leadership team plus a board member or an advisor, and then you have 3 or 4 teams of teams covering different products, markets, or territories, and now the business actually sits pretty again, and it's really good. So a 40-person business works. I call that a performance business, or it's entered the performance phase. And then there's the lifestyle boutique, 3 to 12 people, and do not spend time in the middle. That's the desert. Too big to be small, too small to be big. So make a decision. Do you want to be 12 people or 40 people, but don't be in the middle?
The middle, well, I've been in the middle and I am in the middle with some of them.
How many people?
Well, it depends on the company, but it's that middle bit there is headaches you would not believe, mm-hmm. HR issues you wouldn't understand, mm-hmm. and it's just like complete chaos in every single angle. Yeah.
And it's all predictable. At about 17, 18 people, you get office romances.
Oh, yeah, but it's not even that. It's just like you all of a sudden become someone's parent 1 minute, yeah. their yeah. boss the next, and it's absolute chaos. So yeah. for me and Brad to move out to Dubai and almost separate it, so we have our own managerial hierarchies now in the offices in the UK, and we've completely kind of pulled ourselves away from it because it was difficult to manage at that level. So kind of by pulling ourselves out, it's definitely helped. One thing I want to talk on is kind of the next phase of all this.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been doing a few talks in the UK at the moment where I say it's all about ambassadors now rather than influencers. And I think the kind of influencer mood is over and we should be looking at having ambassadors. And the idea that many brands out there will try and have 100 influencers posting about their product or whatever, when really they should be having 1 or 2 ambassadors that really kind of embed their product. What's your opinion on that?
Yeah, so this is the consolidation that we've been talking about, and it's about, I really feel that you need to have an anchor key person of influence. Obviously, I talked originally about you becoming that person, but if it's too late for you to become that person, bringing that person into the business is smart. So, you know, let's say we're here in this podcasting studio. If they have 1 top podcaster who is a shareholder in the business, who evangelizes it, who runs everything here, and then builds a bit of a community of people who say, well, if it's good enough for you, it's good enough for me, I want to be part of it as well, then that's going to work for creating a fast growth business. So for example, Score App is our new technology company. We hit about 3,000 subscribers. And then we went and brought in this guy called Ali Abdaal. Ali is a podcaster with 4.5 million followers on YouTube. And we approached Ali and said, hey, we think you'd be a really great fit as a lead ambassador. And his first video that he made did 100,000 views in the first 3 days. And suddenly people are talking about Score App. A lot of people are talking about Score App. And people are going, oh, did you know Ali Abdaal's involved in this business and all that sort of stuff? So he did just a soft announcement that he's an investor and all of those sorts of things. Perfect example. And I've done 1 second deal. I'm only going to have 2. Second deal with a guy who's got 2.5 million, but they're bigger businesses. So we've got Ali, who's got a lot of startups and early stage. We've got a guy called Chris, who's going to be much bigger businesses. And we've got those 2 ambassadors who are going to be consistent over a course of time to build that business. Now, between the 2 of them, they've got 7 million followers and growing. A SaaS business needs about 15,000 followers to get to 15,000 subscribers to get to 100 million valuation. So you can kind of work out that actually if you can get those 2 relationships right, or 1 or 2 of those relationships right, you get a 7 million people as your ambassadors, 15,000 paying subscribers, you've got a $100 million business.
How are you structuring those deals?
So I need them to be investors in the business, right? They have to have integrity when it comes to I've invested in the business. And then based on additional performance, we have share options for expanding shareholdings and those sorts of things.
So you're not going to these ambassadors and saying, we'll give you X amount of pounds over the course of a few years. You're literally saying, look, no, I want have shares, have a scaled approach.
An influencer deal would be, we'll give you X amount of pounds. A sponsorship deal would be, we'll give you X amount of pounds. The difference between what we're talking here is someone who's bought into the success of the business. Mm. They're a true believer. They're a true believer to the extent that they don't actually get any liquidity unless the business does well. So they're not just simply saying, oh yeah, buy this stuff, you know, because they're the sponsor. It's like, no, no, I use it. I use the product. I love the product. I'm an investor in the product. And I'm going to be talking about this for the next year or two and get used to it, because this is a big, exciting thing that I want you to know about. So you want some of those people who are true believers.
We did exactly a very similar deal with Unthin, our hair loss product. And then I've just invested in a food business who had David Gandy as their ambassador. And as soon as I saw David Gandy has invested his real money and he's happy to be a brand ambassador, I was just like, take my money. Because at that point, it's like the most, like the number one model in the world is going to be a brand ambassador for this product. It's like the valuation is triple what it's worth on paper. And I, you know, you look at that, those sort of deals, and you look at KSI and Logan Paul. And I think I want to get your opinion on that and how that deal worked out.
Well, my favorite one is the actor Ryan
Reynolds,
right? He followed me on Twitter the other day, randomly.
He
follows 1,500 people and he followed me. Wow. And Richard Branson follows me on Twitter. Weird, right? Anyway, Ryan Reynolds, he's the highest paid guy in Hollywood, not because he's getting paid for acting, but because he's taking stakes in companies. He's actually putting his money where his mouth is. He takes a significant stake and he actively builds and promotes those businesses right through till the exit. And, you know, that's the model.
Right. Well, look at Wrexham, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I was speaking to someone the other day about football clubs and how I would never ever buy a top flight football team, because like, what can you do apart from just throw more money at it? And that you should be buying the fan base. So I was like, Newcastle United is, you know, been recently purchased, probably one of the best purchases to have, because the fan base stayed the same in the Championship as it did the Premiership. And Wrexham, you know, one of the oldest football teams in the world. So people are now building their brands within the football clubs and communities. And I think we're going to keep seeing this happen.
Yeah.
You know? And I mean, Ryan Reynolds, if he invests in any company now.
Oh, he's minted, right? And the company was mint, but he's a sure thing. He's a bet, a safe bet now.
And then now they're building a media company behind it with all the stuff on Disney Plus, and you can kind of follow it along their journey and see how they're competing. And him buying the football club is one thing, him building the media company, which, you know, is...
Well, he's actually an entrepreneur now. Like, I rate him higher as an entrepreneur than most entrepreneurs and most actors. And... you know, I think he's, you know, what blows my mind is that parallel universes, there were all these celebrities actively complaining bitterly for having to pay $8 a month for Twitter. And they're like, oh, I shouldn't have to pay $8 a month for Twitter. You entitled snobby shit, right? And then here's Ryan Reynolds. He just shuts up about all that stuff. And he says, you know what? I'm a celebrity. I'm going to go and build these brands and I'm going to leverage my brand and my IP and my network and my talent. And while they're complaining about $8 a month, he's building a $1 billion company.
You don't have to have opinions anymore on people. Just look at how they act with things.
Yeah.
And so many people are entitled in this world that they just moan about everything. Just crack on and get on with your job and everyone will love you for it. One of the things I want to discuss is how you're forming these business partnerships. You've got 8 different businesses now. We've got 3 that are doing pretty well. 2 others that are, you know, at that stage of getting started. My approach has always been having that conversation of, what are you trying to do? What's your aim? When we launched our hair loss product, the guys, our business partners, they're a medical consultancy company. We did their rebrand, their website. They took me out for dinner and I said, what's your grand ambition? And he said, well, I've got this hair loss thing I've been working on. Like, this hair's not real, it's paid for. And then we were like, cool, let's start a hair loss company. So how are you kind of doing these partnerships? Where are you finding the deals? What's your move forward with that?
So I remember when I had one business and a mentor of mine had 13 different companies. And I remember thinking, how on earth does that happen? How is that even possible? I can barely run one. Strangely, there comes a point where you can actually easily have multiple businesses and you can add value to multiple businesses. You've got a core team and it's you normally have a top 5 people. The number 1 and number 2 run the business and, you've got an established product. And then you do a value add that gives it oomph, superpowers, and then let it get on with it. So for me personally, I've got these different companies. We've always got a great leadership team. I buy into the business and then use my networks. I use my, playbooks. And we just run the playbooks. And so I've got a series of playbooks that we put into each business. We put those in and let the team get on with it. But how do I structure? I normally buy the business, or a portion of the business, and then we get on with it.
So how much of your time has been spent in each business at any one time? Are you, are some of them, you kind of, you know, does it go in waves? Are you like sometimes all in on one of them? Are you sometimes like day a week? Or
it goes in waves, and I roam around having adventures, and in my travels, magical things happen that elevate the businesses. I don't know how that sounds absolutely ridiculous.
No, because every conversation you have adds value. You know, yeah. I've always said that the best use of my time is just to meet cool people.
Yeah.
Have open conversations, have no agenda, just chill, chat. And then all of a sudden you'll have something random come out the corner of the room, which no one expected. But sometimes people go in with such structured reasons to meet people. It seems too forced, nothing ever happens. Yeah. The business is all about getting on with people, having some cool people and having a good time.
Every business needs functionality and vitality. So functionality is the ability to perform tasks. Vitality is the irreplaceable life force. So life force energy, if you take Ryan Reynolds, he has added some life force energy to Wrexham. He's added some life force energy to the mobile phone company. And that is, he gets some attention for it. He attracts more talent to it. He opens some doors for it. Yeah, he's just a center of attention for it, all of that sort of stuff. So I call that role a vitality role, not a functionality role. Maybe that's just a toffee way to try and justify my existence. But
I am important.
Yeah, I am important. I'm doing a vitality role, people. But it's not a functional role. It's not something you can just wrap a job description around. It's a different role.
Do you have somebody who's kind of like your right hand man or woman that you know? Because our businesses are very much a case where, you know, I'm ADHD as hell, you know, running around, meeting people, coming up with stupid ideas, and then Brad will come along and be like, no, it's good, no, it's bad. Yeah, okay, I'll pick this piece up and try and glue it back together.
Yeah.
Do you have anyone that's kind of in that role?
Several people. So I've got my executive assistant who basically organizes my diary. Everything goes in the diary, and she's constantly reorganizing and doing all the logistics and that sort of stuff. And she does all the emails and everything. I've got my financial CFO. So my CFO, David, has been with me for many years and is an amazing guy who's raised hundreds of millions for different organizations, for company growth. He's done countless M&A deals. So David and I talk through every deal and you know, whether it requires funding or, you know, restructuring. David's my CFO. And then we've got a couple of other guys, Mike and Glenn, who are very good at like sales, marketing, getting things moving. Donna is like an incredible operator. She does a lot of operational excellence. Essentially, look, as a leadership team, you typically want CEO, CTO, CFO, COO, CMO. So there's your kind of five on the executive team with an executive assistant who kind of coordinates as well.
Because then you can throw any question in the room and someone there will know the answer.
Yeah, so you can get that done. So around me, I've got those roles.
In terms of kind of your different businesses you've got, do you believe in the thesis of folding everything into the existing sort of headline? So obviously the backbone of your main business, I suppose, is key personal influence and the dent trading and that sort of thing.
There's kind of three sides to what I do. So Dent Accelerators is an accelerator program. We've had 4,000 companies come through the accelerator. It's got a great reputation. It's won major awards for training and development. It won the Business Advisor of the Year. It was Business Enabler of the Year. Offices in UK, Australia, and Canada. I think of that as our relationship engine, right? So most relationships tend to start with the Dent Accelerators. And it's also the thing that gives us the best track record, because in those accelerators, that's where we share the playbooks and people apply that to their business and they get a great result. And that's what gives us credibility, because people can see the results of our clients. And then separate to that, we have the growth services companies. So the growth services is B2B services that help companies to grow. So we have advertising, capital fundraising, publishing, SEO. So we have an entire group of companies that are all built around helping companies to grow. And they're agency based, right? So each one has about 10 or so core members of the team. And they operate as agencies, but they are very focused and they operate as a group. And then there's tech. So ScoreApp is the primary piece of technology at the moment, marketing technology. And it all fits with my central thesis of developing entrepreneurs to stand out, scale up, and make a positive impact in the world. So for me, the unifying theme is that everything I do is around that idea, and we just do it in different ways. So one way is providing technology that helps with that. One way is providing services, companies, and agencies that helps with that. And one way is the training and development accelerator programs.
So those agencies, are you starting them from zero? Are you buying them out?
Always buying.
Always buying. And what are you looking for when you're buying those businesses?
Amazing feedback from customers. So what we have always done is that our clients find an incredible supplier and then they go in the forum and go, oh, we're working with this company called August Recognition. August is this company that helped us to win awards. They found the award we should enter. They helped us collect the research. They helped us fill in the award submission. They were amazing to work with. They were so good. Oh, really? Tell us about that, right? Let us get in touch with them. So then we reach out and get in touch and we say, hey, we've got more clients like that. That one, could we structure a deal? Could we buy a percentage of the business? Could we buy the whole business? Do you want to partner together? Like, so we then come up with either a significant stake in the business in partnership with the owner or the founder, or we buy the whole business.
Where do you see the sweet spot? Are you talking you take 80%, they keep 20? Are they all different?
The sweet spot for me is 100%. I want to own the business.
Do you lose the kind of founder connectivity and their drive? I mean, how are you structuring that?
Not necessarily. A lot of the time, either a founder gets to a point where they want more stability to earn more income and to grow it, or they might want to leave and do something else. You'd be surprised. Most founders can get a business up to around $750,000 to £1 million, $1 million US dollars. And at that point, most of the running of the business can actually be done by a pretty normal person. And this goes back to my teenage years. When I was a teenager, I worked in McDonald's and we ran a multi-million dollar restaurant. The store manager was 24. The shift managers were all 21. And everyone doing everything was a teenager. Like, I was 14. I became a crew trainer at 15. So I was actually training other staff at 15 years old. And we ran a multi-million dollar business. I remember during lunch rushes, we used to do $2,000 every half an hour or something like that. So, you know, we were kind of like turning over, you know, 10,000 to 20,000 a day, I guess. But what it struck upon me is that businesses, like, you don't need someone who's ex-Google or ex-Microsoft to run a business under 50 million. You know, like businesses that are 1 to 20 million, you can take someone from Starbucks, you can take someone from a pub, you can take someone from an agency, you can take someone from... I mean, recently I sold a company, really successful exit. I bought the business, sold it for 10 times more than I bought it for. And the guy running it was a really great guy who used to run another agency, and we got him to come across and run this business. He tripled the revenue of the business. He got the profit margins up, got some really great anchor clients. I literally, across 3 or 4 years, I spoke to him 5 or 6 times.
Love it.
Yeah. You know,
I think once you've got a business on tracks, right, when it's on rails and it knows the direction it's going and the systems are in place, I mean, it's kind of half the reason that I think the agency model is changing so dramatically as well, is because you've got all these different services breaking out that if you're trying to do all of them at the same time, you've got too many different rails running in two different directions. There's a guy, Mitch, who we had on the podcast yesterday, who does nothing but email outreach. His whole business is email outreach. He's doing £2 million, been going for a year and a half.
Nice.
And all he does is he has a system, one service. If you don't want that service, you don't buy it from him. And he's just grown it by doing email outreach for it to get his own clients, and they get the same service he's giving them. And it's just an amazing business. He's got half the company in North Macedonia, half of it amazing. In Manchester. But you asking the question, do you need to be there anymore? He's like, my drive and my grit will get us some places, but realistically, it's on rails.
In many cases, the entrepreneur can be quite a disruptive force after a certain point.
Well, I know that for me because
I can tell that about you.
Yeah,
You'd be great at kicking the first doors off the hinges, and then eventually, you're looking for doors to kick down, and everyone's like, "Can we just get on with doing some work?" No, I want to kick the door down.
100%. And if you ask the team, like Steph, who's our strategy director, she openly says, you're annoying sometimes because I'm constantly trying to find things to disrupt.
Yeah.
So me moving over here She was thankful. She's like, get out of this office because you're becoming chaotic.
Yep. And that's self-awareness, and everyone needs that. So there are some people who are operators. They're really good. Give me a business and I'll run it smoothly. And there are some people who are disruptors. You know, give me an opportunity and I'll juggle it into existence. But once it's going,
pass it on.
I need to pass it on to an operator. So the classic roles within business in the big end of town is CEO. So that's your visionary. Your visionary is normally the person who can raise the most money from the markets. They're the ones who people will invest behind, and they're going to assemble a leadership team who are true believers, and they're going to set the vision and all that sort of stuff. And they're going to kind of push towards a hard to reach outcome. And that's their job, right? Just to kind of give everyone that push towards this is the excellence we're going for. But then the COO normally runs the business. So if you take most big companies, the COO is the day-to-day operator of the business, and that's who everything gets done by, and that's where all the decisions get made and all of that. If it's running properly, a COO, Tim Cook was running Apple when Steve Jobs was, you know, very ill, and, you know, and then he took over and the business has actually gone 10x since Steve Jobs passed away because the COO is running it without disruption. And then you've got CFO, who's great at making sure there's resources and, you know, helping with fundraising and all that sort of stuff. CTO is building the tech. CMO is generating marketing results and sales teams and that sort of stuff. So you got these kind of classic roles. And it's funny, even at a smaller scale, those are the classic roles. Those are the key roles. And if you're you and I, right, if you're the CEO, less is more. Think about it at a big company level. You only need one CEO for 5,000 people. You know, you only need one CEO for 100 locations, you know, that a bigger business might have. So less is more when you're an entrepreneurial personality.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, because everything you were saying there, I'm like ticking it in my head, like, yeah, that's true. We do that. That's exactly what happens. I want to touch on we've only got kind of 10, 15 minutes left. I want to touch on two things. The first one is kind of, do you believe moving forward that influencers, or should I say ambassadors, now know their value is much higher than what it used to be, and we could be in a position where the ambassadors don't even want to work with brands, they want to create their own brands? Like, how do you see this kind of moving forward?
No, because the people who have the brand, the ambassador type person, let's say they've got 1 million followers, they're on a treadmill. And the treadmill that they're on is the content creation treadmill. They have to keep the algorithms happy. They know that they are on, they know that they're ahead of the curve. They know that they are in a very unique position, and they do not want to mess it up by going and actually running a business. They're looking for the right partnership. And there's most of these people are very, very smart. They know that the thing that adds the most value is their audience, and their, you know, their brand, and they're looking for the right partnership to make the most out of that. They need you as much as you need them. They want to monetize. They want to turn that audience into something. They want to do something very respectful for their audience. They want to do something that is a good decision. Most of these people are paranoid about getting involved in some crypto pump and dump thing and that everyone suddenly hates them, and for good reason. So they're looking for something that is a high quality opportunity that's scalable, that's the right opportunity for their audience, where the business itself hasn't gotten too big, where it's no longer something where they can give equity, and it's not too small where it won't scale. So it's very hard for them to find the right opportunity as well. So when those two things happen, it's like, you know, fireworks. It's that spark and that explosive powder, and the two things, you know, it's chemistry. It's a match made in heaven. So that's what you're looking for. They're not going to try and compete with you. They're going to try and keep their audience engaged.
So would you say that the strategy for most brands right now should be growth hack as fast as you can to say 2 million ARR and then try and find an ambassador that now has, you have credibility, right? You've built the business to a reasonable point. You now have the credibility to go to an ambassador and say, look, come on board, let's take it to 20 million. Is that the strategy you'd say?
Yeah, so long as growth hack means that you're genuinely building something that will scale and that won't embarrass the ambassador. You want to make sure that you get it past the point of being held together with sticky tape. So at the point when you bring on the ambassador, you want to have a really good CTO. You want to make sure that the developers have done a great job. You want to pay the money to do a security check on all your systems and find out, are there any back doors that have been left open? So you want to go through a bit of a rigorous check to see if you are seaworthy before you get that thing out there, because an ambassador relationship with someone who's got millions of followers is going to blow the business up. And it's great if you're prepared for it, and it's not great if you just suddenly disappoint everyone.
Cool. In terms of kind of looking at the landscape of the world right now and the way the world's changing and stuff, and COVID was obviously such a big thing for the world, how do you see general business as a whole moving? Obviously, we're sat in Dubai right now. I'm from the UK. You're from Australia?
Originally from Australia.
Yeah, you're from Australia.
Lived in the UK for 17 years.
How do you see the world changing? Like, how do you see everything happening? Are we looking at now everyone who's looking to start companies coming across the Middle East? Are we still seeing a Western-dominated force? How do you see that kind of playing out?
A little bit different to what you're describing. I see that we have clouds and dirt, right? And I don't mean Gary Vaynerchuk's clouds and dirt. I mean cloud computing and geographical reality. And take a place like San Francisco. San Francisco is one of the most impoverished and affluent places in the exact same geographical location. And what is happening in San Francisco is you have some people who are living in cloud land, which means their income is made in the cloud, and some people who are living on geographical dirt, which means that they are separate from that cloud and none of that money falls on them, right? So they're completely impoverished, even though they're literally on the same geographical plane. So they walk past each other every day. So you either earn your money in the cloud, in which case you're becoming more and more affluent as we speak, and every day gets easier and easier, and every day your reach goes bigger. And once you're in the cloud, you don't even think about geography. So you're up in the cloud. You've got people who can sign up to your products anywhere in the world. They can subscribe. The currency conversions automatically happen. The subscriptions already happen. The product gets delivered wherever they are, et cetera, et cetera. That's the ultimate cloud-based business. And you're non-geographical at that point. And then you can just roam around talking to people, and wherever they are, they sign up or they don't, and it's all happy days. As soon as you then get into geography, you're back into this dirt. And even if you're in the right you could be in Dubai, right? So you're sitting there going, oh, you know, should everyone move to Dubai? Well, you could be here and you might earn no money, because if you earn your money in a geographical way, you might be an Uber driver. You might be a laborer. So it's not that the world is heading towards any particular geography, because you could be in San Francisco and you can be broke. It's that the world is separating into two societies, the digital economy, the cloud-based economy, and the old economy, living on top of each other. They're describing wealth inequality, and it's the wealth inequality of living two separate lives. And it's a little bit like if we're all running a marathon and some people are allowed to drive and some people have to run, and the people who are running sit there going, this is just so, I do not understand why these drivers keep winning. It's like, well, they're using a technology that is just so far advanced compared to the way you earn your money or how you run your race. You know, you're not in the same race. Even though you think you're on the same track, you're not on the same track. So yeah, that's the big divide that's going to happen. And AI is going to speed this up like you would not believe. Like AI is basically going to just drive a wedge, and it's going to accelerate most people down and give them downward momentum, make their life harder, and it'll accelerate a small number of people up. And the reason for that is because it has the two superpowers to make you hyper-consume or hyper-create. Unfortunately, most people are such passive observers. They're not conscious of what's going on. So they're then immediately caught in the net of hyper-consumption. And, you know, they don't understand why their life gets harder and harder each year. And it's because you're doom scrolling. You're spending your most valuable resource on your phone consuming nonsense, and that predictably ends up in a cul-de-sac. Whereas these other people are using AI to hyper-create. Their businesses run on AI. Every employee they've got is supercharged by AI, and they just go up and up and up and up and up. So we're going to have these two societies that just move further and further apart.
What do you think is the solution? What should everyone be doing? Is it an educational problem? Is this problem been the fact that the education system hasn't changed for the last how long?
The education system's slowly changing, and there are alternative models. Education is part of it, because the education system really is built around interchangeable, replaceable parts. So we have built an educational system that is designed to create component labor. Component labor is essentially, you are one of those people, I can take out the old one and put in the new one, right? So this component replaces that component. You're a lawyer, okay, you're a paralegal, you're a paraplanner, right? So all of that if you can easily define a job, it can be done by AI now. So the educational system can't keep producing component labor. So that's a big part of it. But that'll happen too slow. It'll create the divide will already happen. At this late stage in the game, the only real solution that I think, and I shouldn't be advocating for it, but there are some solutions that are being talked about that I think are very smart, which are every public listed company or every company above a certain valuation has to put a pool of shares into a pot, and that pot is allocated as a one-off payment to every baby, and that baby gets like $7,000 to $10,000 on day one of their life of a balanced portfolio of private equity and public listed companies, and they can't touch it until they're 65. So that we're actually building a pipeline of people who at some point will be self-sufficient when they're too old to do anything. And then you probably can take some of that pot and then rein some money on people who, you know, who can't, who are just not going to keep up. The truth is that we're about to hit a part of society where, you know, like it, we're about to have a massive disruption. AI on most measures is better than 75% of general practitioners, GPs. It's better than most paralegals. It's better than most paraplanners. You know, it is, you know, it's a songwriter. It's a this, it's a that. And what people don't realize with AI is that as soon as it gets the right data and learns, it's suddenly better than everyone everywhere within minutes. So like chess, a great example is when they give chess to an AI, it doesn't know how to play in the morning, and then by the afternoon it's the greatest player that has ever, and it taught itself chess. And it does the same. There's something called persuasion, alpha persuade. Alpha persuade is a game where the AI has to persuade you to say a sentence without you knowing what it's trying to get you to say. And it's actually a language game, and it's a highly advanced game, but it is essentially like a spy game that they would train spies on. And of course, it's phenomenal at this. So it can persuade people to do things that they don't even know they're being persuaded to do. So we're going into that world. So we're going to have to come up with some systemic changes. Who knows what it's going to look like? Remember this, for the last 10,000 years, most of the last 10,000 years is kings, queens, dukes, duchess, lords, and peasants and serfs. So 5% of ultra elite, 95%. You know, bottom, and that's the default. That's the default switch. So unless you take really deliberate action like we did 100 years ago to build a middle class, we revert back to that default.
That was one of the, like, genuinely one of the best monologues I've ever heard in my life. Because what you've essentially done there is you basically said it's game over. You've essentially listed there that there's, like, there's no way out. AI is going to make this divide. Sort yourself out. We're going to literally have to give away a private equity scheme to citizens. Otherwise, it's no food.
We're going to have to. Well, it won't be no food because everything will be created. But we'll have to have a very new way of organizing society. We have to take deliberate action to build a middle class. If you don't take deliberate action, the absolute default in society is like a 90-10 ratio. So 90% of everything is owned by 10% of people, and 10% of everything is owned by 90% of people. So this power law, the internet creates a power law, Google and then everyone else, and then, you know, Instagram and everyone else. So, you know, it creates these very uneven distributions. And if you look at the people who have followers on Instagram, it's a small number of people. Like OnlyFans, for example, I think OnlyFans has over 2 million content creators. And there are something like 300 who make $1 million a month. And then there's like 1,000 who make 100,000 a month. And then the average OnlyFans person makes 150 a month. And they're doing all the same sorts of things. So it creates a very uneven power law. And the platform owner wins. The landlord, right, the king of that land, is the winner no matter what you do. You're all serfs, and there's a few dukes and duchesses, but everyone else is replaceable. So that's the default, and we have to take deliberate action. We have to actually think about how do we want to design society. Now, the one thing I will say, it's not all doom and gloom for a couple of reasons. The bottom billion or the bottom 2 billion who don't have access to a GP, you've suddenly got the best GP in the world in your palm. the bottom 2 billion people who don't have engineers and architects, now you've got an engineer and an architect in your local area, 100 of them, as many as you want. So there are billions of people whose lives will become radically better because suddenly AI is in their area and suddenly they've got access to this phenomenal support. And you only need a couple of smart people in that location to use the AI and incredible things will happen. So it'll have a lifting effect if you're in the bottom 1 to 2 billion, I think. The other thing is that we can't see around the corner yet. So if you and I were laborers on the land in the agricultural age, and then we look across the paddock and there's a steam tractor and we see it for the first time, and we go, holy, what is that? This steam tractor can literally plow an entire field. It does the job of 90 of us. What are we all going to do? And they say, oh, well, this is the beginning of the industrial age and there's going to be these factories and you're going to move to a city and you're going to work in a factory. Oh, is that a good thing, a bad thing? I don't know yet, right? I don't even know what a factory is. My brain can't comprehend this idea that we don't work out in agriculture. So then we go to the factory and you go into factory labor and you say, oh, yeah, look, these computers, they're going to do all this and now you're going to work in a white-collar factory in a big building in New York. Oh, wow, okay, what will I do? Oh, you'll move little things around this thing called a spreadsheet. Really? Yeah, it's going to be your whole job. Your whole life will revolve around these spreadsheets. Really? Okay, exciting, right? And then you then say to us, this AI is going to do all that stuff. What are we going to do? Well, you can't see around the corner yet, right? Mm-hmm. So we are at one of those corners where it's beyond our comprehension what the economic model looks like. It's beyond our comprehension what society looks like. But it's not beyond my comprehension to know that the default is haves and have-nots, and we have to design something that is positive for the majority.
Amazing, amazing. Is there anything else you want to say on the podcast before we wrap up?
We just ended on societal change.
Yeah, so. I thought I can't really follow from the end is nigh.
Should we talk about space?
Thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
Cheers.
Thank you.